From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells. Our first guest this morning is Park City resident Chris Fisher. He's the founder and expedition leader for OSearch. Fisher's company is a recognized world leader in generating critical scientific data related to tracking and studying great white sharks. OSearch has just returned to Nantucket with its team of collaborating scientists for its 35th expedition. The expedition started last Saturday and runs until August 26th. It has ventured into the heart of the important white shark aggregation site with the goal of increasing the sample size of tagged, sampled, and released white sharks. Chris joins us from the OSearch research vessel, the Big Boat, off the coast of Nantucket. Chris, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Glad to be here. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. So tell us about your 35th expedition to Nantucket.
It's hard to believe it's 35 expeditions, but we're continuing to build on our work here in the North Atlantic. The scientists want approximately 60 white sharks tagged and released and sampled for all of the 17 research projects we're in the midst of, and we got 44 tagged so far, so we're in the midst of trying to continue doing that along with a local science project for the people of Nantucket where we're studying the bacteria on the teeth and mouths of these white sharks so they have the right antibiotics on hand here should they have an incident in the future.
You have a lot going on. There are 17 reported studies. There are 29 principal investigators. You have 19 individual institutions that are all involved in this particular expedition.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about increasing the rate of learning, right? The sooner we can understand the lives of these large sharks in the ocean, that's the soonest we can then begin to manage towards making sure all of our grandkids have plenty of food to eat from the ocean because they are the balance keepers. And so it's a fundamental data set we have to have to manage the system. Much like the wolf in Yellowstone, the white shark is the wolf of the ocean, and we just had never been able to get the data around its lives so we could ensure they recover from their historic lows in the early 2000s of about 9% of their population. Fortunately, we've got that turned around, and we're trending the right way now here in the United States on both the East and West Coast. And this will be the data set to ensure we can manage them long-term so that they keep the system in balance, really preventing those second-tier predators from running amok and wiping out all the food for our kids to eat.
Chris, one of your taglines that really says it all is, don't fear the fin. And you use that when you talk about, well, as you say, increasing the rate of learning. And it all goes back to abundance in our oceans. And I've just got to ask you, has anyone ever studied the bacteria on the teeth of a great white shark?
Well, in the past, they tried to get them off of sharks when they were captured and killed, but then all the bacteria changes. So, no, I mean, the one thing that's been transformational for the science is the lift we have off the side of the ship, which allows us to pick these white sharks, you know, up in the 4,000-pound-plus range out of the water. And then scientists can actually get down and swab their teeth and their gums and their tongues and get that living bacteria and then immediately begin to culture it here on the ship and then test it against antibiotics so we got the right antibiotics in our hospitals for people should they be needed. And we pioneered the work back in 2012 down in South Africa when we tagged 39 white sharks down there, or 40. And now the community of Nantucket and the Nantucket Data Group is integrating all of our science into how people use their beaches and how they move around the island and all their emergency services all the way down to the antibiotics in their hospitals. So, well, most people don't realize when you do have a shark incident, the biggest single problem is infection. It's worse than blood loss. And a lot of times loss of limb or loss of life comes from infection. And so that's because they don't know what antibiotics to use. And they just start trying antibiotics with someone who's been bitten by a shark. And if it's been lots of times, it doesn't work for a few days. And they try another one and that one doesn't work. And then all of a sudden you have a runaway infection, which can be really bad. So what we're able to do is give them a good profile of all the bacteria in the mouths of these animals so that they have the right, most effective antibiotics on hand, and they get to people as soon as they can with them, which really reduces the impact of the event.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that the general population doesn't really think about. I mean, we're bit by a dog and we know to be treated for rabies possibly or whatever other antibiotics have been proven to work. Dog bite. Shark bite, we're thinking about the trauma of these injuries and not the practicality of something like you're talking about, the antibiotic need for fighting infection.
What's very interesting about it is we're doing that sort of bacterial work, but then we're also taking bacteria off of the shark, and a lot of these bacteria are developing new types of antibiotics, and we're just in the process of patenting our first antibiotic that have come from the bacteria of sharks, because before the lift, the science community didn't have the capacity to get this bacteria off the animal and then culture it and handle it appropriately. And so now we're getting ready to patent our first couple of drugs that we've been developing at the University of South Carolina over the last few years. And they're showing great promise with things like staph and MRSA. So it's going to be very interesting to see where not only the antibiotic work for humans, we've done that before, but this new drug discovery, yeah, we're going to solve the puzzle of these sharks' lives. We are going to make sure our kids eat fish. We are going to do that. You got to expect to win because otherwise our kids don't eat fish. But this new drug development for humans is just kind of a whole new field. It's extremely exciting if we can make an impact on some of these tough bugs to handle that we're all dealing with in our hospitals and other places.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Park City resident Chris Fisher. He's the founder and expedition leader for OSearch. They just started their 35th expedition, which is more than Jacques Cousteau. How many did Jacques have, 28 or something? Or
somewhere around 22 or so, I think.
Okay. Anyway, he's off the coast of Nantucket. He's standing on top of the big boat so we can get a good cell signal. And let me mention this. You know, when a lot of people think about catching sharks or attracting sharks, they think about good old boys, you know, drinking beer and chumming, you know, throwing stuff out the back of the boat. Why don't you take a couple of minutes and take us through how sharks are caught?
So, like, right now, we're not even chumming, right? I think one of the things we've learned over the years, look, if chum works, it's so interesting. People get lost in the chum discussion. We would just set up and start chumming and all the sharks would come to us and we'd catch them and our work would be done. But it doesn't really work that. Like anything, whether you're going out on a river outside of Park City, if you're not located, if you're not where the fish are, you're not going to capture them. So it's really all about being located. And our fishing master, Captain Brett McBride, who I've been on the water with for 20 years, is just the most gifted waterman I've ever worked with. And, you know, this spot that we're on now, 5.5 miles east of Nantucket, we'd never been here before, but he was looking at the charts, and he's like, hey, you know, I think we need to go here. The way the water's moving, the way the bottom structure is, it looks like where we're getting them in Africa and where he got them in Mexico. And we got out here on Sunday night, and we got one on Monday. So he has a gift, and working on white sharks around the world, it allows you to kind of figure out where they like to be and how they move around. And so he gets us located, and then really we just put out bait, and we wait. And we're seeing here that all of the activity we see where we have opportunities to capture sharks is coming in and around the tide change because there's a lot of current here. So right now I'm standing on the top of the ship. I'm looking out over four sets of gear that's in the water and the contender and the guys are out there. And the current is racing. But in another hour or so, that current's going to start to slow down as we come into the tide shift. And you get this three-hour window of slower moving water, and then the water pauses and starts shifting back the opposite direction. We're seeing 90% of our activity with the sharks coming during these black tides and these little three-hour windows that we get two or three shots at each day. But we have baits in the water, and we're just waiting. And the science team is prepared, and they've run through their protocols. This is a game of patience, right? It's a marathon, not a sprint. We're out here for 20 days or so. And, if we get a shot at, you know, a couple more animals, we'll be thrilled. To have one the very first full day we were here was amazing. Then we had 2 days of weather hold, and now we just got back out here this morning, and we got a nice little stretch of a few days of good weather. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the next few days.
So, Chris, for folks that aren't familiar with what happens after the fish is caught, after the shark is brought on board with the hydraulic lift, that people that are not familiar with your diagnostic or your tracking capabilities, why don't you take us through what happens in this sort of NASCAR pit stop,
do? Yeah, when a shark picks up a bait, the guy's out in our contender's little 30-foot center console. we'll get control of the shark, which, you know, if we catch a 1,000-pound shark, we'll have control of it in maybe 6 minutes. If it's a 4,000-pound shark, it might take 35 minutes. And then once we have control of the shark, we walk it back to the ship, and the ship has a lift that goes over the side of the boat. We'll swing the shark into the lift, much like you kind of swing a skier into the beach, you know. And then the lift will pick up the shark, and two hoses will go in its mouth and a towel over its eyes so it can breathe while it's in the lift. And then we have a science team of around 7 people on the ship right now. We'll proceed to do 17 research projects in about 15 minutes. The first thing we'll do is we take a blood draw from the animal, and then that immediately goes into the little lab on the ship here where they'll measure its stress levels and understand what condition the shark arrived in the lift at. That blood sample will also be used for hormone testing and reproductive testing, general health assessment, microplastics, some other toxicology work. While that's happening, we'll insert an internal acoustic tag into the animal, which works for 10 years when it swims by receivers along beaches. We will be picking parasites off the animal. We'll get the bacteria off its teeth, tongue, and gums, and bacteria off its gills and eyeball and cloaca for drug discovery to work. And we'll get a muscle tissue sample. And then we'll roll the shark about halfway through that time period, and we'll attach a spot tag on its fin. And this is what everyone follows at osearch.org on the Global Shark Tracker. When the shark sticks that dorsal fin out of the water, it'll ping its location through a satellite into the shark tracker, and that allows us to track the animal anywhere in the world for real time for 5 years. We'll also put a tag on the back of the shark that stays on it for 9 months and pops off and then reports its data. And that tells us the temperature of the water the animal was in and its dive profiles. You know, what depth was it spending its time and what were its dive profiles looking like? Then we'll do all our morphometrics and measure it. We got a whole study going on their eyeballs right now, so we'll get specific imagery of their eyes. And about that time, we're coming up on that 15-minute mark. And, we get a fin clip for genetics and all the genetic work. And then we'll drop her down in the water and wait till they kind of wake up and swim off. And that's kind of, a lot of people ask, like, what it feels like to catch a white shark. You know, it's really kind of stressful, really, you know, because you're dealing with a big animal. And once you get control of it and get it in the cradle, your disposition kind of shifts to nurturing like a baby. You know, you're trying to take care of this animal and get all the data we need to collect off of it as quickly as we can with as minimal impact. And then when we drop it down and it swims away and look around and all the people are okay and the shark swims off strong, you get this kind of great sense of relief. I call it the white shark slide. So it's more about being just stressful in the early time because there's a lot going on when you're getting the shark under control. Then you go to this little nurturing feeling, and then you kind of have this tremendous feeling of relief at the end. And then you're just inching forward, right? We got the scientists want another 17 sharks from this Massachusetts body of animals here, and it's just a matter of time and money now and repeating the method. So we're getting close to the end. We're in the final third of the project here.
Wow, that's so exciting. So if you go to osearch.org, and that's OCEARCH, can you find this a 15-minute clip of all of these diagnostic tests going on? It must be really exciting to watch.
Yeah, I mean, if you go to osearch.org, you can track all the sharks in real time. If you go to the OSearch YouTube channel, that's where you'll see hundreds and hundreds of clips of big sharks and all sorts of special segments on the different science projects and some of the stuff on education, because we have this integrated STEM educational curriculum for K through 12. Kids can track the sharks and learn math and physics and, you know, dynamic data sets. And so, yeah, there's all sorts of different ways to connect across the social platforms as well as the YouTube channels where it's at if you want to see a bunch of cool shark stuff.
Great. Well, from the first time that we spoke with you, Chris, I've enjoyed my shark tracker app that I just click on occasionally to see which sharks have popped up recently. And I can only imagine for a school kid, it's that much more exciting than for someone like me. but it's really a wonderful thing. And I'm wondering about, you know, how a community like Nantucket engages in this. They're closer to sharks, but they also know more about the truth and the scientific research about sharks versus those of us that are landlocked. And, you know, we do things like watch Jaws, you know, 25 years ago and still think about that. Or it was probably more like 40 years ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's interesting when we move around the world and work to engage with the different communities that the sharks are living amongst. And there really is a big difference between these people who live on islands. You know, island people, their whole life is really connected to the ocean and integrated into the ocean, whether it's just traveling to and from their island or just getting food out of the ocean and the industry surrounding it, tourism around it. So the island people here in Nantucket, I mean, they got a very level head about it, right? These people have been living on the water all their lives. They're super helpful, too. Like, they understand what it takes to operate out here, and they're fully supportive of OSearch and help us in a million different ways and really make us feel at home when we're here. So, yeah, the island people, you know, they are very sane about the situation, right? Very practical. They get it. And they also, they tend to look at the ocean differently than those of us who don't live right on the water, because they look at the ocean and they realize it's a wilderness. Much like someone who lives in Park City thinks about when they're going on a hike in the forest. They don't just blindly hike in the forest. Like, they're aware if they see a cow and a calf moose on opposite sides of the trail, they go around. They can be aware of what's going on in that wilderness. And island people look at the ocean like it's wilderness. I think a lot of us that live on the mainland and just drive to the beach occasionally just kind of go to the beach and jump in and don't really look at it and see what's going on and then make good decisions of whether or not that's a good place to go in. So island people are always totally plugged into the system. Nantucket is really one of the leaders, I think, in the community that engages with the ocean here. And it's a lot of fun to work in these type of places.
Acidification of our oceans is killing plant life that sustains the food chain. It also provides oxygen to the planet. Recent studies have observed an increase in malnourished whales. What have you observed about the nutritional health of great whites?
Well, I think it's interesting that you mentioned, you know, all of us living in Park City, over half of every breath we take, the oxygen comes from the ocean. So we all are connected to the ocean, no matter where we live. And this plastic situation that you're talking about is far worse than even people think who are plugged in and aware of it and focusing on it that don't spend time on the water. We see plastic everywhere. We're seeing our whales die because their stomachs are full of plastic. It's been happening to our birds for a long time, and turtles as well. The white sharks, we are detecting microplastics in their system, and we're really expanding our microplastic work on the white sharks, because when you look at the top of the food chain, the apex predator, the white shark, is kind of a bioaccumulator of everything that's in the system, right? Because something starts out really small, something a little bigger eats it and accumulates what was in the thing that they ate before, and then the next biggest size up eats the smaller thing, and it accumulates all the toxins. And so when you get all the way up to the top of the food chain in the white shark, it is the real indication of ocean health, because it's the top of the bioaccumulation of all that consumption in the food chain. And so we're really starting to get a picture on, well, what do our white sharks have to endure to live because of everything that's accumulating in their system up through the food chain. We're finding kind of really shockingly high levels of mercury. We're finding microplastics. The fish are eating it. The sharks are eating the fish. The seals are eating the fish. And the sharks are eating the seals. We are all eating plastic now in the fish that we eat. And so that's really an emerging field that's kind of going to a new level on this particular trip. And, you know, it's not great news. I think this is something where every single individual has to be accountable for their own actions, because it's going to take us all. No more single-use plastic bottles. No more straws. No more lids. No more balloons. I hate to say it, man, but no more balloons. It would shock you. I've picked up thousands of balloons out here on the water. And it's ending up in our fish and then in us. And it's something that we all really need to take some personal accountability for, because it's going to take everybody to be proud of the ocean and the planet we leave our kids. And this plastic thing is something everyone can really make an impact on. I think the other thing is, too, for all the ladies out there, take a look at the cosmetics you're buying. There's this chemical called squalene that they get from killing sharks. A lot of cosmetics have squalene in it. And there's also great options that are squalene-free. So, you know, little moves like that on all the individuals make a big difference.
Chris, back to oxygen for a moment. I moderated a panel of experts last October for the Future in Review conference on the health of our oceans, and one of the scientists there did some math And what he basically said, well, this probably will not happen, but what he said was, if all the plant life in our oceans were to perish through acidification, then that would decrease the amount of oxygen akin to us. You would have to, the oxygen level would be, if you were 125 feet above the peak of Everest, which is lights out, there would not be enough oxygen.
That makes sense. I mean, two-thirds of our oxygen comes from the ocean, right? So I'm an optimist, right? We have to believe we're going to win.
Right.
Because we have no choice but to win. Look, we're on the greatest spaceship in the world. I'm not into flying to Mars and living in a barn. our spaceship here has oceans and mountains and powder skiing. All we got to do is maintain the ship. And so we got to expect to win here when it comes to turning around the planet. And things like acidification are obviously a real issue. We move toward alternative fuels and stuff. Hopefully we can make a big impact on that. And again, that's going to require every individual.
Yeah. Chris, going back to the microplastics, of course, we know that the most recent news or trends in microplastic is, to not use straws. And as you know, Park City has banned single-use plastic bags, which is a start, what we can do here inland to help our oceans. But in terms of plastic that you see that's not to the microplastic stage yet, but floating around the oceans or collecting on our beaches, what do you see mostly?
We see mostly balloons, plastic bags, and single-use plastic bottles. I mean, that would probably be 90% what we see.
Right.
Then you see other things, too, like, discarded fishing nets and things like that occasionally, but that's much more rare. But primarily those main few things is what we see. And I think the way to really affect it is for all of us to not only try to minimize our use of it, but also to vote with our dollars, right? Buy from companies that are making business and doing good at the same time rather than companies that are just making business. And reward those companies. Then it's going to become the best business for all of our companies to create a more abundant future for the planet, because they're going to win in their market. And when we're buying our everyday things, there's lots of good options, and there's plenty of bad options, too. And in the era of connectivity, you can look on your phone real quick and figure out who you should be buying from.
Right. One of the things you talk about is how the ocean's biggest problem is the deficit of data. And, of course, data is what you're collecting there. And you also say that we need a confluence between salty fishermen with their anecdotal stories and academics. And that's what you have on your boat. It sounds to me like it must be unique. How unique is it?
Yeah, I mean, what we're really doing out here is bringing street smarts together with book smarts, right? Yeah. I mean, scientists, and you can't change the future of the ocean on a fisherman's story. You need a peer-reviewed published paper from scientists, and I'm happy to say we have 27 peer-reviewed papers published now and another few dozen being written. But the scientists have no boats, no money, and they don't know how to catch what they study. And in the past, these two communities did not come together. There was a lack of respect across the communities. There was no common vision. There was no selfless disposition of, great-grandchildren first, ocean first, planet first. And what we've been able to do here at Search is put all those silly agendas behind us, just focus on our grandkids and bring a group of people together with different skill sets to make what used to be impossible actually really easy. I mean, when you got a guy like Captain Brett McBride and the rest of the fishing team, DJ and Mac, these guys are salty guys. Well, if you want to catch a 4,000-pound white shark, you need some salty guys. And they make that look very easy. And then they can deliver that animal to the science team where they can then execute science they could never dream of because they never had safe access to stand next to a 4,000-pound white shark and ultrasound it or get a fecal sample or a semen sample or a tissue sample and apply the latest technology. So, getting everybody on that kind of common vision with a selfless disposition and think about the future and our kids has really been the magic, I think, of building a team that's allowed us to explode the rate of learning. I think we probably learn somewhere between 20 and 30 times faster than the traditional ocean research model, because in that model, an individual scientist would build their capacity and try to go get one shark, and likely they can't get one, but if they did, then they would do one thing. And I think especially in a place like Park City, where a lot of the people spend time in the woods and there's fishermen and hunters, there's a lot of respect for the beast. And when we caught the first animal the first time and we did one thing, I was like, we need 15 more smart people here right now. When we just caught this thing, why not learn as much as we can? And that was not how the system worked. The individual said, no, we can't do that. I'm trying to get ahead of the other scientists. I said, well, I'm trying to make sure our grandkids eat fish sandwiches, and best I can tell, we paid for this, and my guys put their body parts on the line, so we're inviting everybody. So we've been able to disrupt this individual institutional approach, which is the way the system was set up. They're not bad people. It's a bad system. We're trying to disrupt that system. And because it's the only place in the world you can stand next to one of these animals, the science community basically knew, like, we either need to go and leap forward, or we're going to be left behind because someone else will go. And we've been able to build big collaborative teams. Like John said, I think we got 27 scientists from 19 institutions, you know, doing 17 different research projects. We have scientists here collecting samples for scientists who will never even be out here, because we can take that blood and send it to five different people, and they learn five different types of things because they have different disciplines. And then you can solve the puzzle touching the fewest amount of animals. And that's ocean first. That's shark first. And so it's been a long road and a brutal road disrupting that, especially in the early years. But now everybody kind of gets it. And then you throw in a little open sourcing of data, and oh, my God, you got the science community is spinning then. But again, by open sourcing the data, we got the whole world involved in it. And it's going to take us all if we're going to pull this off for our kids. So open sourcing the data, giving the sharks a voice, has allowed everybody to engage in the project in real time and really begin the early years of building a global ocean movement.
Yeah. Chris, we are almost out of time, but one final question. You catch a shark, you bring it into the hydraulic lift, you perform all of your tests, and you determine, you think that this shark might be pregnant, so you do an ultrasound to confirm that. The question I have for you is, where will she birth her shark if she's in the Northeast, if you catch the shark in Nantucket? Yeah. Where will she go, and why will she do that?
So where we are now in the fall, the sharks are gathering here, and Canada's emerging. We're going to Nova Scotia for an expedition next month. We believe they're gathering up here to mate. So I don't think we're going to find any pregnant white shark here. But if we were working in March down south off of Florida or Georgia, that could be the case. So these sharks up here in Massachusetts, we've identified where they're giving birth. Believe it or not, some of these animals are mating here in Nantucket, we believe. And they're giving birth in the Hamptons on the south shore of Long Island. So they got that hybrid lifestyle. And they'll give birth there. They mate here. They have they can't mate until they're 20 years old. So they can't replace themselves for 20 years. Then the females can only mate and give birth every other year because they have an 18-month gestation period. And they'll give birth to an average of about 8 babies. And so we're seeing these sharks here gathering in the fall and early winter. We believe they're mating at some time here. And then they will go down south off of the southeastern United States and overwinter down there, swing offshore. And then 18 months later, slide up into the south shore of Long Island, drop off their pups, recover, and then do it all over again every other year. So the big question we have now as our work evolves up in Canada is, where is the Canadian white shark giving birth? From our work in the Pacific, we found separate birthing areas for two separate sites. And we're really, as that work emerges and we get more sharks tagged up there, wondering if that Canadian white shark will be dropping off its pups in a similar area or a completely different area. And that'll be something we'll hopefully be figuring out the next couple of years.
Park City resident Chris Fisher, founder and expedition leader for OSearch. They began their Nantucket expedition 6 days ago. They're 6 days in, and they'll be going until August 26th on the big boat. Chris, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Got to give a shout out to all my kids back there in Park City. I miss you, Daddy. Miss you, Sarah, Lila, and Luke. I love you, and we'll be home before too long. And hi to all our friends out there. It's just an amazing place to be able to live, and that community is just feel so blessed to be able to call that place home.
Travel safe, my friend.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute.